Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday Night Discussion Group for January the 21st, 2014. We'll be discussing again the great pain deception, faulty medical device is making us worse, by Steve Ozenich. We'll be discussing chapter 27 tonight. Physician, heal thyself. And this is going to be packed solid full of ways to heal yourself if you got TMS, okay? So this is going to be another great show. I know y'all guys thinking I say that every time, but hey, it is a good show every single time. So I need to go ahead and say a disclaimer before we start. I do need to let everyone know that this is a peer support group. None of us are medical or mental health professionals. And if you have a medical concern, you should see a properly licensed physician, or we'd recommend a TMS physician. Of course, you know, after the medical diagnosis or whatever. Okay, which is a great thing. But with that being said, we're going to give it over to the great summarist, Bruce MC.
Yeah, Summa Theologica. Summa Medica, I guess.
There you go, buddy.
You've got to remember that chapter 27, Physician, Heal Thyself, is also stands at the start of a new section of the book, which he calls A Philosophy on Life, Acting on New Knowledge and Healing. Steve says that the latter portion of this book is about life and living, practical and philosophical, immediate and concise, a viewpoint on healing as seen through the eyes of many who have healed, including moi. Meaning himself. Become more aware of how you react to life and how your darker side motivates you to do good deeds and bad, and you will discover a new path. There is no one direction. Healing is all about understanding yourself, your behavioral characteristics, the way in which you respond to stimulation, and your biography, your personal biography. Hence chapter 27, Physician, Heal Thyself, How to Free Yourself from Pain, consists of a list of how-tos, that is, how to heal yourself, phrased as do's and don'ts. And there are a number of sections that I can summarize, I think, with one sentence each. I've tried to do that to make this sort of like an accordion, so we can make it as brief or expand it as much as possible. Steve echoes a lot of the same things that Dr. Sarno advises in healing back pain. He says, one of the sections, the first section is get a physical exam. Seek professional help first in order to rule out the need for further outside help. And then he says, another section, talk through your current issues, not about health. As Jane Pennebaker maintains, you should get a good confidant that you trust, someone non-judgmental. I think Pennebaker thinks that's better than journaling.
You know, in that part right there, Bruce, does that not, you mean the friend that he's talking about, that James Pennebaker talked about, that you should get if you're going to talk to somebody? Don't that sound exactly like the way you should be talking to yourself, too? Somebody that's non-judgmental, somebody that's non-critical. Well, that's,
it's kind of hard to do that with self-talk. Sometimes that sometimes that inner bully comes out to beat you up when you try and do that. And
yeah.
The next section, he says, learn a new positive language. Steve says, throw away all aids and support devices, which is what Dr. Sarno says, and change your internal language from can't to am. Don't procrastinate. This is what psychiatrists refer to as resistance. And then he has another section after this, self-talk, washing your brain out with soap. Negative internal language creates an atmosphere conducive to suffering. Change your internal dialogue to the language of improvement, because by repeating it long enough, it'll eventually sink in. Then he has a section, joy and sickness, which he says are sides of the same vibrating coin. By viewing yourself as broken, old, sick, and incapable, not in control of your health, your body responds physiologically to adapt to those beliefs, to make it so, as James Luc Picard would say. It's funny how much of Star Wars creeps into Steve's philosophy. And he bases this on the biological studies of Bruce Lipton at Stanford. He also advises, build some fences. Learn to set boundaries. That is, learning to say no. And he cites a book by Susan Newman, The Book of No, which we can go into in more detail later. And then he talks about exercise and fitness. Again, he echoes Dr. Sarno, advises you to bore tension out of your system by physically and redundantly moving through physical activity until your brain gives up the obsessive fear. Activity is the single most important aspect of healing. He emphasizes that. And then he goes into a lot of things like liminal threshold, pain increasing as activity level increases, and then this
proprioception. Explain that liminal threshold one more time.
Well, that's where all change takes place. Steve talks about how he focuses his attention at an area where he's not hurting. Like if he's out running and his back hurts on the left side, then he focuses on the parts that are healthy. And that's that, what does he call it? That, what you were asking about, that...
liminal threshold?
Liminal threshold. He says that's what he was doing there, psychologically speaking. I guess there are books on this and so on. And he also says stay somewhat socially engaged. Steve says to stay socially engaged or depression may creep in. Social activity enables us to share our problems. And then he says praising the almighty dollar, that is. He says if you have a job where capital is bothering you a heck of a lot, whether it's contributing to your stress, get another job, change career. Then he talks about relationship. Full, healthy, and forgiving relationships are another set of keys to a healthy, pain-free vessel. We feel safe and alive when connected with others. That goes along with his philosophy of transcortification, I guess. And then he gives the examples of Brendan, which we can go into. He sent him an autobiographical synopsis of his life, Brendan did, and Steve describes it as the perfect TMS storm. And then he talks about touch.
Hey, Bruce, can you comment some further on Brendan here in a little bit when you get done with your summary?
Oh, yeah, we can all talk in. I'm just I'm trying to get through the sections here quickly.
Well, I just didn't get to read that page.
We're out of the woods.
Okay, go ahead. You doing good?
Yeah, I have that all in detail, yeah. He talks about what Brendan's perfect TMS storm consists of. And then Steve talks about healing connections, the value of touch, and he uses that example of that Ohio State study where the rabbits who are fed the same diet have lower lymphoids in their blood system if they're petted, if they're touched and handled. And then he talks about daddy's influence, which is the last section. I don't know, it kind of sits out of the stream of how-tos, but he says fathers have trouble showing affection to sons because their own fathers were absent or unaffectionate. And that's what we were talking about at the close of last session, about how this is passed on generation to generation, that sense of low self-esteem that goes through history, much of history. So there we got through it. So those are all the sections. Those are all the how-tos that Steve gives as advice for how to heal yourself.
Okay. Well, since you've done that, I'm going to start at the back here, and I'm going to work back towards the front.
All right.
Healing connections. Touch is one letter from ouch. And I would say he's summing up in here how important it is to have connection with, loved ones, people that you know cares about you, somebody that, you know, is going to be there for you. It's important to have that. And anyway, Forrest mentioned, but that he was wanting to talk a little bit about this.
Shall I jump in?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
I just thought, so it's four paragraphs in this section, and the second to last paragraph, I just thought was, I just really enjoyed reading it. I think one of the things which has always interested me about this book is this idea of Turcordification. And I think there's a lot of, obviously connections are really important in psychology. Often it's called attachment there. And he's got this paragraph, which I just thought was great. He says, everyone, even rabbits, because he's been talking about rabbits, needs nurturing attention and touch to be heard. And in this hearing, each heart is reconnected with another as metabolic functions are stabilized and restored. So he had been talking about metabolic functions. That's the Ohio State study that Bruce mentioned. These physical symptoms represent the emotional distance we maintain between us. We suffer because of the pressures we place on ourselves to succeed, to go it alone, to be independent. And in the process, we forget that we need to stay connected, loved, and secure. Dr. Weil said that he's seen several people's back pain disappear after falling in love.
Ain't that awesome?
No longer. I thought so also. There's another thing earlier. He says a similar thing. From the beginning, TMSing is the and I love how he talks about TMSing, like that behavior that we have. Sometimes we do these TMS activities, is the resultant effect of conflict in unresolved interpersonal relationships, including the relationship with self, the emotional loss of which has never been expressed away, and by which the fear of abandonment remains an ever-present memory. I just love those
I think
sentences.
Steve also has a really good summary of this phenomena in of touch. He says, touch eases the fear of isolation, and that reduces the level of stress hormones in the body and releases all sorts of good chemicals, profoundly affecting the body's ability to heal from pain and disease. He puts it all in a nutshell right there. And hey, we could draw out the chains of serotonin and all of these different feel-good chemicals.
Yeah.
But he says it all there in two sentences.
Absolutely.
I thought that was really good there.
And I loved... He also connected it with chiropractic. Like he said, okay, this is how chiropractic works. Chiropractic works, much like massage does, through touch, because it gives that to us, something that we need. In terms of the chemical, I can't resist being... I'm a bit of a biochemistry geek. So you can toss in the Latin occasionally, and I will toss in the brain hormones. For me, the cuddle hormone is called oxytocin. We actually have a well-known hormone that gets stimulated when all that stuff happens.
Dennis, Tom, what do you think about the cuddle hormone, Tim? Oxytocin? Is that right?
Oxytocin.
Yeah, I think out of all the therapies, you know, that don't work, that people blow small fortunes on, like acupuncture, and I've had 200 acupuncture sessions of all kinds of other things. But I think one that's probably worthwhile doing is massage. A good hour and a half of massage, because that will help with that touching, even if you're paying for it. You cannot help but come away feeling relaxed and better and easing, you know, your emotional pain after having a good hour and a half massage.
I think that's awesome. I think that is completely cool, man. Enjoy. I know you got something to add about this with the IFS.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
I mean, can I ask, like, each time we get back to self, is that not a connection, you know, for us and a freedom? That's what happened to me through a session Thursday night. I basically had an agreement that self was going to take care of you know, a little part of me there. And all of a sudden, I just had this pressure just lift off of me. And all of a sudden, this big old smile came to my face. And I was like, whoa, this is some good stuff. But it was about me being connected to me, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, but Herbie, you got to tell us about this. We want to help tell us the story, the Thursday night story. Like, What happened? You went, you don't have to go into the details. I don't, but.
Oh, no, I don't have to go into details, but, you know, there's, we all have we all have the id in us. Everybody knows that. We all have the id. The id likes to have a good time. The id likes to get mischievous sometimes. But anyway, I had a picture of myself when I was a kid, and I know how to make pictures leave. I have styles to make pictures get out of your head, but I couldn't get this picture out of my head. It was a picture when I was a 15-year-old boy, and I was told I was going to die, and I was laying in bed, and that picture just stayed there. It just stayed there, and every time the thought would come through my mind, I would just have this weakening feeling, okay? It would only last just a little bit, but it was just a bad feeling every time it would come to my mind, which wasn't all the time, but it was, you know, affecting me and had affected me for the last, I ain't going to tell the years because I ain't going to tell nobody how old I am no more. Anyway, I'm kidding. Anyway, Enjoy invited me to, you know, join the IFS group on Thursday there. And wow, you know, I love doing things with images and visualizations and sort of things like that. And we went in there and did an IFS session, which is totally different than just only visualizations and stuff like that. It's where you actually talk to this part that you see. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, there was four parts that looked just like me. Every one of them was me, but one was mad. One was fearful. One was there was four of them, and one was there watching out over me. And anyway, by the time I got through the fourth one, which was fear, and behind the fourth one was that picture of the little boy that was sitting there scared. And when I got there, and I made an agreement with the other four that I had seen in my imagination, that the self part of me, the complete part, the part that knows better, the part that knows how to do and live right. Some of us call it the Holy Spirit. Some of us call it God. Anyway, the inner self, when I made an agreement with that self part of me was going to take care of that child, all of a sudden, I didn't see me laying on a bed anymore. All of a sudden, this poor kid that was laying on his bed grew up and became a man and came over and gave me a big old hug. Like, my gosh, here you go. Thank you. And all of a sudden, this just lifted this negative energy just lifted completely off from me. And it was me being connected back, you know, and losing a spirit of fear. It was fear was that last one that we asked to step to the side. And I lost it. I actually lost three other ones, but the fear was the strongest, I believe. But anyway, it was awesome. It happened in like 10 minutes. So that was a connection. Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's an amazing process.
Yeah, and that was a connection. That was a healing connection for me. You know, and that was with me. Now, don't get me wrong. If my woman gets mad at me, I am hurt. I'm a hurt puppy. You know, I'm a grown man, and I should know better. But you know, I love that woman, and if she gets mad at me, I'm a hurt little baby dog. You know, and I can even feel it. You know, sometimes in my bones.
Yeah, you know? That's what Gabor Mate says. That's is something left over from the first time you were rejected by your mother. You adopted that isolation. That's what happens with rejection. You adopt isolation. And so when you're rejected years and years later, you automatically go isolate yourself. You withdraw. Yeah. And that's like the, what is it? The silent treatment. That's a good one. You could go on to for weeks, make it into a cause de célèbre, make it into your way of life as so many do. But
man,
yeah, it's like an ancient, or it's like primordial. It's like something that occurs in infancy with that narcissistic scarring. It's like a strategy you've adapted.
But the thing is, Herbie, that you could work with that part too, so that it didn't feel that way. you know, when you had trouble with your lady friend, because you know, it would take, it would probably take way more time than that.
Yeah.
You never know about these things. Time is really, you know, not the issue. But still, it's buried so deep inside you. It happened a long, long time ago. And so you'd have to spend more time getting to know it and going through probably a number of protectors until you really got down to the exile and that sort of thing. But you could change that too. There's no doubt about it. The other one was probably easier because even though it was very traumatic, you were a lot older. So you had a lot more, you know, resources going for you. But when you're just a little guy and you get rejected, it's the end of the world, and that's that. So naturally you're going to get knocked back into that whenever you have that same feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's why a stormy childhood with a lot of threats of abandonment through divorce winds up with somebody being alienated and isolated for the rest of their life.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've seen it. I've been over at people's houses and to go talk to them, you know, be friends with them, and they would be there by themselves for really their whole life. And I never asked them why you're living here by yourself. I just thought that's what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
We never really know, you know, until you start learning, right?
That's right.
I noticed that when I was a kid in high school, all of the people I picked out for friends were alienated and isolated and arrogant and full of intellectual pride. And then I realized every single one of them had gone through a divorce. And my parents were always threatening to divorce. So I ID'd with a crowd that was like that. And no doubt it reinforces the values.
Yeah.
The people you pick out like that at an early age. I wasn't cognizant enough at the time to realize what was going on. I can see it now really clearly.
Yeah. Well, that'll bring us to the next one is, I'm going to kind of go over to the right before I go back. It's daddy's influence, you know? My dad had a huge influence on me to the point that I wanted to be, and I believe most kids are like this, not every one of them, but a lot of them. I wanted to be just like my dad. My dad was really looked up by a lot of people. He was the type of guy that you could shake his hand. You didn't have to make contracts. You knew his word was good. Everybody respected him. He was a golden glove boxer. There was just so much about my dad that people, I don't think I ever met anybody that didn't know my dad that didn't love him. But at the same time, I didn't get all, he was a very busy man. He worked like, I think 18 hours a day. So I didn't really have that time that I wanted to have with my dad, you know? And as a kid growing up, I really felt abandoned. I really felt abandoned all the time. I never thought I was good enough. I didn't think I was good enough to be, you know, loved by my dad the way I don't know. I thought I'd done something wrong, okay? But anyway, as I grew up, you know, I learned better. And but still, when you grow up and you know what was going on when you was a kid, it sticks. It's still with you then. If you know what was going on, you know, consciously it's still with you. And a lot of times subconsciously it's with you and you don't know. But I know.
I think it's interesting what Steve has to say about the problem of the absent father.
Yeah.
He says fathers have trouble showing affection to sons because their own fathers were absent or unaffectionate. But then he says non-praise then follows non-praise until the man has the courage to break the cycle. Someone has to stand up and say, hey, this can't go on like this generation after generation.
Well, I remember hugging him, Bruce, and I told him, I said, I was 16. And even at 16, I was just like I am now in a lot of ways. And I told him, I said, tell me you love me, Daddy. And he wouldn't do it. Now, you got to understand, my dad my dad, you know, is 50 years older than I am. But anyway, I said, tell me you love me, Dad. And he wouldn't do it because he was raised and they just didn't do that, you know. Mm-hmm. But to me, it was killing me in my heart. But to him, it was, you know, this ain't what we do, son, you know. Mm-hmm. But I remember at 80-something years old, he looked over at me and he told me he loved me, you know, and things changed. But that really hurt when he wouldn't say that day. Anybody else want to say anything about the fathers?
Yeah, it's really interesting that at the turn of the 20th century, there were a whole bunch of books that came out, starting with Turgenev's Father and Son, and the play by John Millington Synge, The Playboy of the Western World, and mm-hmm. Ulysses. And they're all about, and then, of course, Sir Edmund Gosse's autobiography is violent fights with his father. All of that whole generation, through that whole generation, the theme of patricide keeps repeating. And that's the end of the Victorian era. And what happened next? World War I.
Wow.
That's when they went against the old fathers, the old ideas of progress, the old liberal ideals. That's when things started getting fascist and the dictatorship started to rise. And that was all that conflict, that father-son conflict, that was subliminal and buried in literature. You can see it repeated again and again. Ulysses, Stephen Bloom, Stephen Daedalus is looking for his lost father. And finds blues.
Gotcha. That's interesting. It reminds me also, I would add Freud at that point. He's the one who did the Oedipal complex. But I think a lot of us can relate to the whole father. I mean, I know definitely my relationship with my father is a huge issue for me. And, you know, is he there for me? Has he moved on? He seems like he's got a new family now, and it doesn't seem like it's sometimes I feel pushed to the side. And it's striking how much that affects me. It's a real big deal. I think this affects a lot of us.
Yeah, I don't think I ever broke down the barriers with my father till he was in hospice. And I went up to see him one day just before he passed, a few days. And all of a sudden I realized him laying in bed next to me while I was talking to him. Mm-hmm. It was the same as when we'd been sailing on a fishing boat out fishing at Saddlebag Lake. Nothing had changed. It just there'd been problems in between, but that original connection was persistent and went on and on and on and on. It was timeless. Big perceptions, yeah.
Everything from childhood just lasts forever, it seems.
Yeah.
And this is something else that enjoy, I'm sure, with the IFS therapy. Y'all can work with it and free a lot of people up, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, okay. You can do it yourself, or you can do it with a buddy, or you can do it with the therapist, you know, whatever works. And I think it's just brilliant. There's a new, Jay Earle had a new program thing going on where you can join up and work through his programs on different topics. And I posted that on the mailing list. I was a tester for that for a while, and it was really, really helpful. Like, that's what I just love about IFS, is they're determined to bring it to the world. They're not sitting back waiting for customers. I mean, obviously they need clients, right? They need to make some money, but they want everybody to have a kick at this can. Yeah.
Okay.
The best thing I've come along in quite a while, and I've come across an awful lot of good things. So that's high praise.
Tennis Tom, I'd be curious. What did you think of this chapter? Did you like it?
Me?
Tennis Tom. Hadn't heard of him.
Yeah, I've never read a page of Sivo's that I didn't like. I mean, honestly, do I like this chapter? I like them all. I'm just amazed at how intelligent the guy is, how much research he's done, and I don't know. It's like amazing how well he writes and. Every day I read two pages and it makes me feel better and hopeful. So, in fact, I'm sorry, but I've gotten ahead a little bit. I tried not to, but I think that Christmas vacation week, and I still read my two pages in the hot tub, and if you made me pick out a page, I wouldn't be able to tell you which one, but it's all great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But one thought I had, okay, about the father thing, I don't know, I didn't have, mine was okay. He did take off after we're adults and tried coming back and taking off again. He just, humans didn't live that long, you know, and the thought of being married to someone for 50 years or something. And I don't know, I think what the average age expectancy around 1900, what was it, 50 or something? Or anyone know what the average age expectancy?
You'd think 50, because I think in the 1800s, the mid-1800s, it was only like in the, you know, mid-30s.
Yeah, but that's just because that was the average age. I mean, people died when they were 5 in those days. Now people don't. You know, but lots of people live to be 80 and 90 years old.
Term hasn't changed that much. It's 80. It was 80 when Sophocles was around. It was 80 when Julius Caesar was around. It's still 80.
How about Stone Age man? What was the average age expectancy for Stone Age man?
Oh, well, that's different. They didn't have any support systems. You know.
Yeah. Well, I think having to be married to the same person for 50 years has got to be TMS creating.
Okay, I'm the only person here who's actually.
I know where you're going with this. You're very
about.
Yeah.
But I'm glad. I mean, I met my husband when I was 15 years old, and we didn't get married for a few years. But believe me, that's
you've been together for a while.
How many years you've been married, Andrew?
I think we've been married 47.
Oh, you did. I didn't mean to make you have to make you defensive about it. But I've never been married, and I've never once even thought about the topic. I'm 65 now, and I could kind of see getting married now, but more just because as you get older, you need someone's help more. But, I don't know. I've never
there. I run into guys like you on the bus all the time. You'd think at my age, I'm 68, you'd think I wouldn't be much of a commodity, but there's a lot of old guys out there who think I look like I'd make a good nurse.
Okay, everybody's heard it. Tennis Tom is available.
Yeah. But I've been married for a long time, and there were really rough times. There's no way around it. But I personally think it's a blessing. I mean, if you can do it and you're not a quitter, then it's worth it. If you married somebody in the beginning who's got something going for them. I mean, my husband is a really interesting guy, and he's a screwball, but he's got good character and that kind of thing. And so we've always been able to work things out as we went along. And we're very happy that we're still together, actually.
What are his thoughts on TMS, Andrew?
No, he thinks it's nuts.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't agree on it. In fact, probably if anything, we disagree on most things. So we have to work hard, and it's good for us. You know, it's an intellectual exercise, because if I can convince him of my crazy stuff, or he can convince me of his stuff, because he's a mystic, for God's sake. You know, I mean, give me a break. Who's a mystic these days? He is.
What is a mystic? Yeah, what does that mean?
That's like foreign to the other person.
Oh, okay.
So that's too. Yeah, and then we have some stuff in common, but mostly it's we're a mystery to each other.
Well, does he believe in, like, witchcraft or voodoo or what? By mystic, what's the...
St. John of the Cross, St. Augustine, Rumi, all the true mystics of the past and all this crazy stuff.
Like that, Kabbalah and anything mystical and various, like, so Rumi, that's not Christianity, that's Hinduism.
I think we were talking about a book, right?
Yeah, we got on a relationship about
and
fathers.
I think the key was that after 50 years, that was going to cause some TMS. And Tennis, Tom, you were talking, right? You were saying that after 50 years,
yeah,
it was going to cause TMS. And where were you going with that? Because I don't remember.
Steve-O, in the end, he says the chief cause of TMS is relationship, whether it's family or extended family, but relationship. I agree with that 100%. I do have a girlfriend, and have had girlfriends, and always the things, and I attribute my right hip to, I won't mention her name, Barbara, it's a direct, and I think Steve-O is 100% right on about relationship. Relationship, family, and the closest people you are can either help you or give it to you. One or the other can help you get over it. I was in the hot tub today. I'm a little tangent on this, but I think it is relevant. I happened to be talking, and some guys in real estate was talking about he'd had a couple of lady tenants who turns out they're renting apartments and were running prostitution out of it. And this got us talking about how it's a shame that prostitution isn't legalized. I think there'd be a lot less TMS stress in the world. And it is legal in certain counties in Nevada. It's legal in Amsterdam in the red light district, and it exists everywhere. And I think so much stress could be relieved if it were, you know, legalized.
Crime from the crime.
Oh,
from
that's that is something else. I have never heard that on this. I've never thought I'd hear that on this program.
Well,
but buddy,
okay.
You know what?
The funny money associated with it attracts crime.
Well, the cuddling brought it up. I mean, it's just an extension of cuddling. I mean, cuddling often leads to other, you know, intimate behavior. And otherwise,
well, you know,
we wouldn't have.
Have y'all seen the? I'm gonna say this off the book here. There's a woman that's getting paid right now to be a professional cuddler, and she's hiring people. I saw that like a month ago on Yahoo. She's being paid to be a professional cuddler. Now,
give it a try. I've tried golfing.
Have y'all seen? And she talks about all the healing effects that it does for her clients. I'm serious here now.
Well, and there's
like rabbits. That's why there's so many rabbits.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh. A bunch of
there, there's similar things going on in Korea. I think that they have kissing rooms, so you can go to a Norebang is a karaoke room, but typically there'll be women there to flirt with the businessmen who often go there. So I've heard. But also, did not go.
Tip of the iceberg about what you did in Korea.
How about Google Images?
That's right. Look it up. But they also have these kissing rooms, apparently.
Yeah. Now you're talking.
It's kind of like prostitution for kissing. Is you just apparently you go there and you pay your money somehow money
nothing wrong with that
changes hands and you kiss.
So you paying it a kiss?
Paying, I think that's the way it works. I haven't looked it up for a little while, but I think that's what they did. Yeah.
I'm gonna Google that. Yeah.
That's pretty good. In the day, if you watch TV, they got these booths. The older programs, they would have these booths. There would be a girl, or you know, for the girls there'd be a guy, and there'd be a kissing booth, right?
Did those actually exist?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know.
Steve-O just had the example about the rabbits that were handled were cured of whatever it was. And yeah. So if it's working for rabbits, why not for humans, you know?
It lowered their cholesterol level.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hey, there's nothing wrong with that. So we got kissing and cuddling rabbits, and their cholesterol levels got lowered, right? Okay.
Yeah. I'll behave myself for a while.
You were bringing up the example of Brendan.
Yeah, I wanted to
do the EMS storm. I didn't list all of the things that Steve said typified his story. I wrote them down.
Let's hear that. Thanks, Bruce.
Steve was saying that Brendan's autobiographical synopsis was essentially summarized this book. It was a summary of his whole book. And he said that Brendan was an example of
a... This is a summary of Steve's whole book?
Yeah, he said that Brendan's biography summarized everything in the whole book. So it's an important little section.
Awesome.
He said that Brendan, he had the first cut of parental divorce and fears of abandonment that morphed into perfectionism. That's what I was talking about my friends in high school. Mm-hmm. And then he went on to have a cycle of sciatic leg pain, skin eruptions, unemployment, obvious vacation syndrome, which he calls leisure sickness, searching for external cures, depression, finding of Sarno, searching the psychologicals, standing against the pain, success as pain moves around, financial worries, and finally full circle to the resurfacing of reduced blood flow when new tension reaches new heights. That's a relapse, right, isn't it? What stands out for Steve is that Brendan's doctors told him he needed back surgery even without the benefit of an MRI. He said it was such a cookie-cutter approach that he was getting funneled through. So those are all of the stages of TMS. It's like there's that rake's progress, you know. This is the way it happens, and this is the way it can conclude, and this is the way you can fix yourself, all in one paragraph there. And he thought that Brendan's story was very good because of its candor and because it contained all of those elements in such a short space. In one letter.
Well, you just called it all out. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Wow. It's like the way it works.
Okay, and the next one, guys, is stay somewhat socially connected. You know, I mean, we gotta stay socially connected. I put a video on the forum there, community off topic. It was Charlie and Jackie, or Jackie and Charlie was the name of it. They were on there doing the swag or the something like that, the swing, or anyway, Forrest came in and asked me, did I do that? I think Forrest is a dancer himself, and you know,
not a good
somewhat.
One.
But you know. You can tell, I mean, I think the guy was well close to 70. The lady was in her early 60s. And those people, to me, in that little 15-minute video on the community off topic there, they look to me more vibrant and more healthy than any teenager, any 20-year-old that I'd ever seen. They were out there getting down, man, and having a good time.
So graceful.
You know? Yeah, and they had like probably 50 other people there that were in their 60s and 70s, you could tell. But they looked younger to me than any of the younger groups I used to hang out with. I used to go and hang out with my buddies when I was in my teenage years, and everybody looked like they was dragged down and half beat up. But I watched that little 15-minute video of those Jackie and Charlie dancing. And they had such finesse, such gentleman. The man was a gentleman. The woman was getting down with the boogie woogie, man. She was making moves that I haven't seen on Dancing with the Stars or anything. A Right Force? Did you watch it?
It was very, very graceful. It was.
I would say that is being socially engaged, you know, and having a good time, getting out there and enjoying your life. And that's what Jackie and Charlie did to enjoy their life. And you could tell everybody there was just full of energy, full of, you know, vitality.
I think one thing that Steve says in that section on stay somewhat socially engaged that really hits home is he summarizes it. He says social activity enables us to share our problems, okay, reminds us that we are never alone, it ends social isolation, but here's the kicker, and also adds competing stimuli to the pain. So it's competing stimuli. That's the way to get out of the pain, whether you're going to move your consciousness to an area that's healthy,
right,
or whether you're going to distract yourself with some kind of concentration, like, what is it, Eckhart Tolle talks about, Herbie was talking last week about looking at the mouse hole, the cat looking at the mouse hole. It distracts you when you focus that way. When you're in the now, in the one, then you've established something that distracts you from the whole pain syndrome. So it breaks it, cuts it off at the root.
And that stimulation does seem important. I like the way that Herbie, when you're talking about staying socially connected, I would have thought, oh, he's going to be talking about having people to talk to, having someone to share your sorrows with, to share your joys with. But kind of the video, what I got from that video is exactly this competing stimulus there. They were having a joyful life. They were having a happy life. They were doing something. It was about their passions, their passion for dance and just music and having a good time.
That's awesome.
A powerful competing stimulus, to use your language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's Steve's language. I thought that was a real important little bit he added in there. Gives you an idea of some strategies you can employ against TMS pain.
Always feel good.
An arsenal of them, a whole vocabulary you could develop from that.
You know, I remember when I was hurt for, you know, the year that I've mentioned plenty of times on here, and couldn't hardly, you know, get up and down out of that bed for that whole year. And boy, I'm going to tell you, the way I felt when I was able to get out and go uptown or just get out and walk around in the yard, get connected to nature, you know, anything to just get out of that house that I called the walls of doom, you know, the room was the room of doom. I mean, man, the whole difference was getting away from that set, you know, place that I had already conditioned myself to believe in was just, you know, you know what I mean?
Well, it's set setting theory. Probably that house contained all kinds of things that were reinforcing your program.
Oh, yeah.
Just physically getting out of there breaks that pattern.
Yes. So that's awesome. Anybody want to talk about socially engaging? Enjoyed, Tom? Something you do that really helps you?
Yeah, well, for me, I'm a bit of a recluse, really, and you know, living way out in the bush with my satellite internet connection, it's really good to have you. I go into town once a week and meet with friends and go for lunch and, you know, watch The Good Wife on TV and that kind of stuff, but yeah, you guys are pretty much it. And recently, I've been going online and going to Adult Children of Alcoholics meetings, and that's been really good too. So, yeah, this is social engagement for me, and I love it just about right.
You and your IFS sessions is pretty awesome.
Well, and you also have that hubby of yours, you know. Mm-hmm.
And two dogs and 6-7 chickens, and you know. Like that, the odd moose.
Love it.
I love them chickens, man. Tom, what was you going to say, buddy?
Yeah, my sport, tennis, it's a pretty social sport, especially the doubles aspect of it. and I belong to a club, and one thing I noticed, it seems like the tennis is secondary to getting off the court and getting to the bar, the club bar, as soon as possible. And I was out there one day, and it started snowing, and this is in Northern California, Mill Valley, where it snows maybe once every 30 to 50 years, and we're on the court playing tennis in the snowing, and the guy says, oh, it's snowing, let's go to the bar. I said, wait, guys, how many times are you going to be able to say, I played tennis while it was snowing? And okay, they just left and went to the bar. So, yeah, it's crazy. So in tennis, though, you get 90 seconds on the changeovers. And that 90 seconds is when in social tennis, non-competitive tennis, you can talk to your opponents, talk to your partner, have an ongoing conversation. And then time's up, 90 seconds up, and then the next changeover, you can continue that conversation. And by the time you played a set or two, you can go through a whole story, you know, or if it's somebody new, say, what do? You get to really get a mini biography. But I'm finding more and more recently where people are just on the court, they just go to the other side. They don't want to talk. They just want to hit the ball and go to the bar, you know, get drunk. So I find that kind of too bad that, you know, the sport I love, that people are not doing it right, you know, so it pisses me off. But whatever. So,
but you're still socially engaging at the bar, huh?
They are, yeah. I go and watch tennis matches on TV while they're at the bar. And but, the social engagement for me is tennis, and I wish these people would understand that aspect of it. But they don't want to connect, and you feel like you're being used. They're playing, and you're hitting the ball back, and they're getting to play tennis, but they're not connecting. I guess what I'm saying, they are not making a connection. I'm being used, and they don't get it, you know. And then their connection, after they have two glasses of wine, they unwind. And then, okay, then they're all jolly and social. But it takes, alcohol to get them to unwind and get. That's why I guess what bars are made for. People go to the bar, their inhibitions are lowered, they have a couple of drinks, and then they start talking to the people around them and giving them their TMS problems.
Psychotherapy.
Yeah, and if they drink often enough, pretty soon they have no frontal lobes, and then you just go around screaming at the top of their lungs all the time. I've noticed that behavior in terminal alcoholics. They're really loud.
And you like to do your mountain climbing and stuff like that too, right, Bruce?
Well, yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
it's kind of like solving mathematical problems with your body. Like, each climb has a little crux place that you have to figure out, and it does distract you. You focus so much on what's right at hand in front of you, like Tolle's cat, that nothing else creeps in. I've seen that where I had a hurting back and sciatica, and then just went up on a climb, and bango, it was all gone.
Yeah.
Totally. And when I came down, I felt good, and it was gone. And that just shows that intimate connection between TMS and emotions.
Yes.
It really is emotional. It is psychological. It is not physical. And it's really hard to convince yourself of that. Even now, I have a hard time convincing myself, because when you feel pain, you keep going, oh, I hurt. I hurt myself. There is something physically doing this. But the little moments like that reveal how the process actually works. I'll be walking downhill and hurting on a hike, and then I forget about it, and then I suddenly notice I'm walking along and it's not hurting at all. I forgot to hurt. It's
changing
channels, you know. It's obviously neural pathways.
Great.
That mind-body connection.
Yep, it sure is.
That's okay.
Right on that. What does he call it? Steve calls that the liminal threshold, the time and space where all change occurs.
Yeah.
And that's the channel you want to be in. Not the one that's tied to the past or makes you worried about the future. When you're right in the zone.
In the flow, in the now.
Yeah.
Okay. The next one's praising the almighty dollar, you know, and how many of us, you know, hasn't worried about money? How many of us hasn't worried about if we got enough? How many of us hasn't worried about if we wish we had more? How many of us hasn't, you know, worried about money? I mean, everybody, you know, at one time or another has worried about money. Some of us get a lot more, you know, obsessive about it than others. Say a bill's due and you ain't got enough money that week, but it's due in a month and you ain't got enough money that week. Well, a lot of people will worry the whole month, you know, and they'll just worry and worry and worry and worry. And then lo and behold, the day it comes to pay the bill, they got the money. And they didn't have to worry that whole time, but that's the connection we make when it comes, you know, to our security and money, right? Or just one episode, right?
Yeah, so, it's like money is a metaphor for something else, for an underlying insecurity in the whole psyche. It isn't money, but it seems like money.
He says perfectionists can take a mediocre job and turn it into a stressful job. Is one of the things he says. What was you going to say, Forrest, or Tom?
Yeah, well, on the Rahe Holmes list, your mortgage or financial problems is one of the components of that list. And, if you're having money problems, it's going to be stressful.
It's probably right up there at the top of the top five in there, or top three, ain't it? Top five.
Paying the rent, paying the bills, yeah.
You mean the Holmes-Rahe list?
Yeah.
And I have people ask me, what is the scientific proof of TMS? I said, look at that list. Have you had any of those conditions in the last, I think Steve says in the last year or on it, within the last year? Then there's your scientific proof of stress-related disease. So there's the science for TMS.
Don't you think that those stressors will affect you a lot more if you've had what Brendan had? That first kind of parental divorce and fears of abandonment that morphed into perfectionism. It's like if you have been scarred, have that narcissistic scar, then you're going to react to these things, to these stressful events, a lot more than someone who's had a stable childhood.
Sure, that's part of the TMS personality makeup. It's three components. It's your basic fixed personality from childhood, I guess, from the time you're 7 years old or five, whenever it becomes kind of fixed, daily stressors, and then whatever the third one was, you know, contributing to your reservoir of rage overflowing.
Because I know people who get even more optimistic when things get bad, whereas I would be going crazy. They look on the bright side, and they're always looking ahead. Even when it seems like the whole world is coming to an end. In fact, that seems to bring it out in them, you know.
And do they get TMS?
No, they don't have TMS.
Okay, yeah, there
they're
you
real
go.
Alpha, optimistic, positive. When they have adversity, then they just knuckle under and they say, oh boy, now I get I have a real chance for a challenge.
Yeah, they see that cup is half full rather than half empty.
Yeah, exactly. All the time they look at it that way. Sometimes to my consternation. But,
yeah.
Another one he brings up here on page 282 is joy and sickness, sides of the same vibrating coin. He says the thought I am sick, therefore I am, sends low vibrational energy out and pulls that which we do not want towards us. It tells the cells they are sick. Bruce Lipton, PhD, has learned through his extensive work on cell function that organisms always match their environment, and as the environments change, the organisms change to adapt to those environments. Your genes adapt to your beliefs. By viewing yourself as broken, old, sick, and incapable, not in control of your health, your body responds physiologically to adapt to those beliefs, to make it so. And I'm like, whoa, you know? How many of us hasn't thought, you know, oh, I'm not good enough, you know, I look terrible, this pain ain't never going to leave, you know, those sort of thoughts, you know, and those thoughts will keep you feeling bad and feeling rough, keep you in pain, right? It's Bruce Lipton, PhD, proved it. Wow, you know?
Yeah, I read an article last week in The Atlantic where the interviewer was asking some noted scientist, when are we going to find a cure for cancer using the human genome? And this guy said, well, we have younger people working on the exact connections. And then I thought of Lipton and his work. This guy is so trapped, this noted scientist was so trapped back in the dark ages of bioscience that he didn't have any clue that environment and psychology could modify the operations of genetic. The interviewer was asking for a silver bullet. Okay, you've got this gene that makes you have bowel cancer, or you have this gene that makes you have, lung cancer, or this gene that makes you be an alcoholic. And they were both right on the same wavelength. They were both, the interviewer and an eminent scientist, were both thinking there was a one-to-one connection. What do they call that? Genetic determinism. And that's totally out of keeping with what people like Bruce Lipton and Candace Pert have discovered about the real operations of biology, how it's self-correcting. Even the ideas like endoplasticity in the brain seem to just escape these people. They're so locked into that mechanistic kind of healing, that mechanical kind of medicine. They can't seem to get out
of it. Well, unfortunately, that is the vast majority of the way it is today, is that the body is viewed as a bunch of chemicals and like a car, and that's why TMS is pretty much a minority, minuscule minority view. I mean, look how many people you got here tonight. It's like, you know, seven of us or something, and I don't know, but I think that's built into the deal too. It's just the system, the culture, the system that humankind is more and more being mechanized and looked at as an object and dehumanized.
Yeah, what is it? Post-Cartesian. Yeah, after Rene Descartes, after the 17th century. It's like a slippery slope. We seem to be sliding down.
So, in other words, or in one of the things that got me to thinking when I read that, is earlier when Forrest said, you know, he was a good looking man, so he hit it right on the head, right? he's saying what he's supposed to be saying in order to feel good, right? When he said, hey, you know, I don't know if he said he's a good looking man, but he said he's looking good. So
trying to explain why Enjoy wanted to see my webcam. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it was. But the thing is, jokingly or not, that's healthy thinking, right? Not being sarcastic, you know, not being narcissistic, but, you know, just loving yourself for who you are and being proud of that, right? That's a good thing to help you get over some, you know, parts of TMS that, you know, if you felt bad about yourself all the time, then of course you would you'd be feeding the TMS bug, right?
Yeah, I mean, I won't take credit for that there, because that was definitely a joke, but absolutely, I think a little bit of healthy self-esteem, healthy self assessment is a good thing.
All right, good deal. The next one's self-talk, guys. Washing your brain out with soap. And one of the things that got me here, Tom, Enjoy, Bruce, everybody, was this lady here that he asked her to write down everything that she was saying to herself throughout the day. Just write it down.
Oh,
anything,
yeah, right.
Yeah, anything that she might say negative to herself throughout the day. And here's a list, and I'm just going to go through them, Sam, real quick. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, this is her list that she would say to herself in one day when Steve asked her to write this down. And it goes like this: you are lazy, you are out of shape, you look like your mother and a frumpy housewife. Ooh, the tears are rolling now. You are broken. You are not good for anything. You don't do enough to be a good mother. You are a terrible homemaker. You never challenge yourself socially or intellectually. You don't deserve what you have. The house, not having to work. You don't appreciate what you have. You never worked hard for anything in your life. You're sloppy. You're pathetic. You're weak. You're useless. Your disappointment, you never finish what you start, you aren't productive, and you are a procrastinator. This is what this lady says to herself in one day.
Mm-hmm. That's a shame.
I'd say that's a lot of parts there, huh, Enjoy?
Yeah, Dr. Sarna refers to this overall view of self as the beleaguered self.
Yes.
Yeah, this lady is always beleaguered.
That's a poor self-image.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, but well, you know, what if it's true? You know, I mean, or is it a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Yeah, exactly.
Both, probably, you know. I mean, if it's not true, it's going to be true if they keep saying it, right?
Yeah, yeah. Or have other people told this lady that, and now she believes them?
Maybe they told her in childhood.
Yeah, or she's got a rooting section somewhere. Someone who accuses her of all these faults. But I think Steve says that you, in this section, you have to change your internal dialogue to the language of improvement. That's what this lady has to do. Because if you say something long enough, often enough, it begins to reinforce the deeper beliefs in a manner similar to priming a pump. Yeah, if you're always on this negative rag on yourself, it's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you have to change your self-talk, your language, the way you talk about yourself.
Go ahead.
Right. So when you're in school, you get grades, you get a report card, you know where you stand. When you graduate and you start living life, no one's there to give you a report card. How did you do today? You know, how did you do this month? We need people who go around and come folly around the day and objectively observe your comings and goings, and, you know, like, and give you a report card. No, you know, this is how you did today. You get a B plus for today, or, you know, you flunked today. Try harder. We're giving our self grades, but we're not objective about it.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, this is something. I feel sorry for this lady. I'm sure Steve was able to help her. He didn't say. He said that the self-help guru Tony Robbins would say that if they would just stop focusing on everything that can go wrong and only focus on the go. It must be noted that positive thinking is not healing solution, positive thinking is only within a step of reversal. As we all know, positive thinking is part of it, but if you just always, but if you think just positive thinking is going to do it, we know that's not going to do it. But it is part of the overall whole equation. But anyway, Tony Robbins said if they just stop focusing on everything that can go wrong and only focus on the go, or I would say only focus on the good, which is not always able to do, right? But at the same time, quit focusing on all the negative stuff. Hey, that takes reconditioning, man. That takes, you know, you've been sitting there beating yourself up for 30, 40 years. You know, probably since you was a child, and, you know, like one of y'all mentioned earlier, I think Forrest or Bruce, all these probably came through the parents saying this to this person. And then, you know, now she's going to have to start believing that she is all that and not less than, you know?
Hence, if you revise your self-talk and make it positive and repeat it often enough, repetition seems like the key here. This allows for the genesis of new beliefs to develop. And the key term here, I think, is belief. You're validating a new value structure for yourself. And you have to just repeat again and again. I think that's the whole business about TMS healing involves repetition to break the old conditioned patterns, whatever they may be.
Yes, under learning new language. You know, that's the next one here on page 280 at the top. It says learn a new language. A new language of confidence shortens time in each of the stages of TMS healing. You must not think that you have TMS. You will know it. The first stage is hoping that you have TMS. The next stage is wanting to believe you do. The next stage is hoping that you are hoping for the right thing. The next stage is thinking you might. The next stage is thinking you do. The next stage is thinking you made a mistake when you first thought you had it. The next stage is worrying about the next stage. And the next stage is being positive that you have TMS. And the next stage, when the pain increases, is not being so sure anymore. And the next stage is certainty that you have TMS. And the final stage is knowing that you have it. And there will be a point where you know it. Doubt will be erased. And the pain will suddenly be gone. Learn a new language. That sounded to me like a lot of reconditioning, huh?
Yeah, it sure does.
It is a roller coaster.
Oh,
my goodness.
Lord. Change your internal language under learning a new language. It was the resistance. You know, you have all that resistance.
Wow. Well, success breeds success. And this lady, for instance, if you know, she goes through her day and fails at everything that happens, she's going to feel lousy, and it's not going to take that. She's going to eventually get TMS pain as a crutch, as a distraction from her crummy daily life, versus doing things, taking the first step, and success breeds success. You do something, and then it encourages you, gives you confidence to do the next task or whatever you want to do. But if it's everything you do is fail or deemed a failure, eventually you're going to get TMS pain, is what we're here for talking about.
Okay. Enjoy, you want to say anything on that?
No. It's been a good conversation, but for once I did a bit of listening.
Okay. Well, the next one he says, talk at the top of page 279, we only got two more here. And it says, talk through your current issues, not about health. And I like what he says. It's the second paragraph down. He says, eventually stop talking about pain and only talk about life. And I like that. In the first paragraph, he's talking about James W. Pennebaker proved that denying mental pain causes physical pain and illness. Does that not sound like a repression or suppression?
Mm-hmm.
As he says, finding the right person or confident can have tremendous healing effects while working on this section of this book. I received this voicemail from a friend, reproduced with her permission. And it says, "Hey, Steve-O, my neck was killing me. Oh, pain, pain, pain. It was because Mom and I were in a disagreement. So I thought, okay, I'm going to call her tonight. And it melted like butter. The pain is gone. Isn't that amazing? I mean, within 5 minutes of talking to Mom, everything's fine. Everything's okay. It's gone. The pain is gone. Isn't that weird?" Hmm. Talk through your current issues, not about health. Anybody want to say anything about that?
Yeah, communication, relationship. The relationships are the cause of TMS, and communication, resolving it with people who've given you pain or given them pain is the solution to making you feel better.
I like what he wrote down here at the bottom, Tennis Tom, Bruce, at the bottom of page 279. It's James Pennebaker again. And I remember watching in that John Sarno video about how John Sarno said most of the things that we'll be going through that's keeping the pain going is the current everyday-to-day pressures. I remember seeing that. And I look down here at the bottom of page, or hearing it, and I look down here at the bottom of page 279. He says, "It is not necessary to write about the most traumatic experience of your life. It is more important to focus on the issues that you are currently living with." And I thought, well, that kind of coincides with the current pressures that we have that, you know, John Sarno talked about in his video. And
it means that you don't have to engage in psychological archaeology to find this big bang, this big emotional bang that's made it all wrong. It's just you have to deal with things on a day-to-day basis that are stressing you and seeing how that's reenacting, perhaps, reenacting earlier traumas.
You have
to deal with it in the here and now. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, different. I mean, there's some people that's had bad traumatic, you know, childhood experiences that do need to go through that. But at the same time, when you get those fixed, everybody's got day-to-day pressures. I think it takes working on that 24/7 till you just get used to watching your reactions. Right, Tom?
Right. Yeah. If you had a bad day, if you were in a car wreck and totaled your car, and that's a bad day. But I know myself. Every day's a new day. I start off. I do a bunch of tasks, and I feel better. And then the next day, it's all over again. It's like my self-worth is how many tasks did I tick off the list today? And it'd be nice to just say, you know, have a overall judgment of your life that you don't have to go doing a checklist every day of all these things perfectionistically and just say, just lying here doing nothing and life's good, and I don't have to do anything today to prove my worth.
Awesome. Enjoy, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah. It's it was a great chapter, actually.
Yes, it was.
A lot of things that, you know, that I'd already heard, but he put it together in a really nice package. So, yeah, good one.
I think this
great
is one
summary.
I say it all the time, but you can't get no better than this show we had here tonight, guys. We covered everything. We covered everything that causes TMS. I think we almost covered everything that causes TMS. So anybody listening, you get to this point, you have learned a lot. Turn around, keep this recording on your MP3, on your iPad or whatever. Listen to it over and over and over again until you let all this sink in so that you can learn how to heal yourself from TMS. We just laid everything out to you from Steve's book on how to heal. And I just want to end it with that. And I want to end it with thanking Tennis Tom for being here and telling us about, you know, all the pretty women he's met and how that relationship's been a good one. And Barbara wasn't too good. But anyway, you know, he's had a good time. And I want to thank Forrest, for letting me know about, you know, free kisses. Or no, no, kisses
they're not
healing.
Free.
Healing. Paid kisses or healing. And also cuddling with rabbits is a good thing.
Yeah.
I want to buy me a rabbit now.
We had a fun one. This was a fun show. It's kind of a little looser. We mixed things up a little bit. It went well. I enjoyed that.
And I want to thank Enjoy for just being here and always giving us the wise advice she gives us. And I want to thank Bruce for always giving us the wise advice he gives us. And with that being said, I'm going to end the show now. And guys, I'm telling you, if you've gotten this far, listen to this. Listen to it over and over and over and do what we have talked about. I don't know if you want to go to kissing booths, but go to listen to it over and over and over until you can get it in your head what we are saying and start loving yourself. Start giving yourself more compassion. Start going out and doing things and just do it for the fun of it. And that's it. Okay. That'll be the
good one, Herbie. Thank you.
Thanks, Herbie.